The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with an article from the December 8, 2025 issue of the New Yorker. What makes Goethe so special? The German poet's dauntingly eclectic accomplishments were founded on a tireless interrogation of how a life should be lived, by Merv Imri. The biographer of a truly world historical writer finds his work weighted with a double burden. He must trace how his subject's private passions and follies gave rise to original art. And he must show this art to be the purest expression of the age, a register of its political and cultural upheavals. At his most artful, the biographer is like a professional juggler, tossing one ball into the air, up go the poet's earliest lyrics, and waiting for the right moment in its arc to toss a second, a third, a fourth, a fifth. The imperious father, the punishing lover, the rise of the bourgeoisie, the decline of religion, the final illness, while cleanly catching the first. The motion is hard to master. Every year brings fat biographies that are collections of dropped balls. But when the correct rhythm is achieved, the balls merge into a fluid arc. A single life contains a whole era of history. Of all major writers, Johann Wolfgang von Goethe offers his biographers the most promising chance to unite the life of the artist with the spirit of his time. They have insisted on the idea of the Goethezeit, Age of Goethe, to describe the period from 1770, when Goethe published his first collection of poems, to 1830, when he was completing his frenetic, hallucinatory tragedy, Faust, and the last volume of his stately autobiography, Poetry and Truth. In those 60 years, he published three of the most significant novels in the history of literature: The Sorrows of Young Werther, Wilhelm Meister's Apprenticeship, Elective Affinities. Dramas, epics, elegies, lyric poems, and treatises on geology, morphology, and color. The poet Gottfried August Bürger liked to proclaim that Goethe was the German Shakespeare. Perversely, the compliment downplayed the variety of his achievements. He was the German Shakespeare, the German Cervantes, and the German Racine, and perhaps even the German Franklin and the German Huxley, compressed into one endlessly energetic and kaleidoscopic figure. Then there was the day job. For 50 years, Goethe served as an advisor to Karl August, Grand Duke of Sachsen-Weimar-Eisenach, the sovereign of one of the many tiny polities that made up Germany. Together, they stabilized the ducal budget, opened silver mines outside Erfurt, staffed the University of Jena, drank and chased women. Goethe's achievements may have been Olympian, but his personality was all too human. Magnetic, moody, arrogant, and frequently lovesick in his youth, he aged into conservatism. Late 18th century visitors to the court of Weimar could have listened to Goethe lament the French Revolution in alexandrines or watched him dissect mothwings under a microscope. They could have saluted him as he tried to assemble a coalition against the French revolutionaries and, after Bonaparte came to power, could have gossiped about Goethe's audience with the emperor, who claimed to have read Werther 7 times, and beseeched Goethe to become his propagandist. By 1875, it was possible for Goethe's first English biographer, George Henry Lewes, to declare that Goethe's influence on his nation has been greater than that of any man since Luther. Lewes' biography was written in a passionate, high Victorian style, facts quaking under descriptions of Goethe's romantic character. We shall see him wild, restless, aimless, erring, and extravagant enough to satisfy the most ardent admirer of the vagabond nature of genius. More than a century later, a British scholar, Nicholas Boyle, opened the first volume of his biography, Goethe, The Poet and the Age, published in 1991, by praising Lewes and denigrating the factions that followed. The National Socialist, who claimed Goethe as the emblem of German cultural purity, and the Marxists, who celebrated him as the original bourgeois revolutionary. Against the ideologues, Boyle portrayed Goethe as a changeable creature, beholden to historical shifts in power, but able to turn them to his advantage with daring and dignity. "We are always recreating our whole life," Goethe wrote in Poetry and Truth. Occupations, inclinations, favorite pursuits, whims, we try them all out, only to exclaim at last that all is vanity. Boyle's biography is a masterpiece of the genre and may even prove definitive, if it gets finished. The second volume of a projected three appeared 25 years ago, with nearly 30 years of Goethe's life left to relate. Since then, several one-volume efforts have entered the field, including Goethe, Life as a Work of Art, published in 2013 by the German philosopher Rüdiger Safranski, the Daily Mail columnist A.N. Wilson's Goethe, His Faustian Life, 2024, and now Goethe, A Life in Ideas, published by Princeton, by another British scholar, Matthew Bell. Bell's biography argues that Goethe brokered a truce between the secular world of politics and the spiritual world of art. He yielded to the theatrical artifice of the Duchy, but yearned for untamable wonders. The result was an unusual form of compromise, Bell writes, with Goethe accepting the reality of political power, but pursuing a full and disinterested appreciation of everything that appeared to lie beyond that power's reach: plants, animals, minerals, light, desire, death, heaven, and hell. He fashioned a religion of nature and, with a considerable sense of irony, preached it to the aristocrats of the Weimar court. From this religion emerged an art that did not imitate the chaos of nature, but created in a manner analogous to nature. Human yet demonic, modern yet mythic, Goethe's vast body of work came, in his words, from the efforts of the individual to preserve itself in the face of the destructive force of the universe. For Goethe, creation and destruction were entwined from the moment of its birth, at noon on August 28, 1749, in Frankfurt am Main. On arrival, he appeared dead. He was saved, he believed, by the fortunate position of the planets. "My horoscope was propitious," he began, Poetry and Truth. The sun stood in the sign of the Virgin and had culminated for the day. Jupiter and Venus looked on him with a friendly eye. His childhood seemed to unite some of the best blessings of existence. Frankfurt was a proud, prosperous, free city. Goethe was descended from a line of distinguished lawyers and councilmen on one side and a family of wealthy tailors and wine merchants on the other. His mother was vivacious, lovely. His father was didactic, a harsh, eccentric lawyer who distrusted Frankfurt's public schools and devoted himself to the education of Goethe and his younger sister, Cornelia. The boy had an army of private tutors for Latin, Italian, French, Yiddish, Hebrew, English, ancient philosophy, history, geography, drawing, penmanship, and music. He was bred to be a lawyer like his father. At the age of 16, he arrived at Leipzig University, pale and thin, with dark hair, a hooked nose, and an extravagant wardrobe. His suitcase contained drafts of half-written plays based on stories from the Old Testament. He despised the law, and later speculated that those born under the sign of Virgo were fated to write. He developed a reputation as a shallow, cocky student, a fop, according to his classmates, uncommonly puffed up. After 3 years, a pulmonary hemorrhage ended his studies and sent him slinking back to Frankfurt, like a wretched little fox, he chided himself. Confined to the house, Goethe read Rousseau and Shakespeare, whose histories of corruptible kings and emperors revealed to him the secret point, he wrote, at which the particularity of ourself, the pretended freedom of our will, collides with the inevitable course of the universe. From his sickbed, he scribbled occasional poems, erotic ballads, and an accomplished verse comedy, Partners in Guilt. In 1770, at the age of 20, he cast it all, save for the play, into the fire. A grand auto da fe, he sighed to his sister. When he recovered his strength, he resumed his legal studies, this time in Strasbourg. The medieval city and the surrounding Rhineland landscape stirred his patriotic feeling. After he met the philosopher Johann Gottfried Herder, a champion of vernacular culture, Goethe started to collect folk poetry. Germanness emerging, he noted in his diary. He wanted to find a dramatic subject appropriate to his new national ambition, nothing corseted or prettified. On his return to Frankfurt, he found it, the life of Götz von Berlichingen, an early 16th century knight with a prosthetic iron hand, whose autobiography Goethe had stumbled upon in the city library. In 6 weeks, he drafted his first major work, Götz von Berlichingen, a sprawling history play in five acts, which staged its hero's shifting military and sexual alliances in the disintegrating Holy Roman Empire. Amid kidnappings, poisonings, suicides, affairs, and the Peasants' War, the plot spirals into utter chaos, Bell observes. Goethe's attempts to hold fast to his honor and his freedom to fight for whom he pleases. Loyal to the emperor, scornful of the aristocracy, and sympathetic to the peasants' desire for liberation, if not their bloodlust, he is torn between medieval chivalry and modern self-preservation. He incarnates a distinctly Goethean type, the exceptional individual who, as Goethe worried, encounters the crude world and must surrender his high qualities and finally renounce them altogether. The play, published in 1773 and first performed in Berlin the following year, was the most beautiful, the most captivating monstrosity, a critic declared. Its mingling of high and low characters, settings, and dialects trampled on the rules of classical drama, and inaugurated a German dramatic tradition. Success brought Goethe relief, but also anxiety. I think it will be some time before I again do something that will find a public, he wrote. Not so. The Sorrows of Young Werther, published in 1774, was his most influential work. It is now as famous for the cult that allegedly sprang from it, young men emulating its protagonist's yellow waistcoat and his suicide, as for its odd epistolary form and even odder story. An ardent young man, Werther falls in love with Lotte, a simple village girl engaged to a dependable but dull man named Albert. Love transforms Werther. He grows exquisitely and obsessively aware of the natural world around Lotte. The details of the mountains, the valleys, the walnut and linden trees under which she stands. In his letters, he imagines Lotte as a naturally occurring phenomena, an innate and ineffable presence. When I close my eyes, here in my forehead, at the focus of my inner vision, her dark eyes remain. Falling in love was an early and harmless pleasure for Goethe. He wrote love letters that mingled lush images of nature with innocent theories of emotion. A true Rousseauian child of nature, as Bell describes him. When I say love, I mean the oscillatory sensation in which our heart floats, moving always to and fro on the same spot, Goethe mused in one draft. We are like children on a rocking horse, always in motion, always at work and rooted to the spot. The events in Werther were inspired by two abutting love triangles. Goethe's infatuation with his friend Johann Christian Kestner's wife, Charlotte, and the suicide of a neurotic lawyer, Karl Wilhelm Jerusalem, who shot himself with a pistol borrowed from Kestner. But the novella is not merely about one man's unrequited love. The critic Georgi Lukács insisted that it is one of the greatest love stories in world literature, because Goethe succeeded in generalizing his experience and concentrated into this love tragedy the whole life of his time. The prevailing romantic view was that passion disrupted the social order and so had to be denied. What dreadful people there are whose minds are completely absorbed in matters of etiquette, Werther exclaims when he takes a position at court to try to forget Lotte. Each episode in the book, Werther's retreat from his home, his failure at court, his despair over Lotte's marriage, arises from his inability to impress his desires onto an artificial and indifferent world. The more powerful his feeling, the greater his isolation. He can imagine no escape but to borrow two pistols from Albert and shoot himself in the head. Whereas Goetz had given German readers a glimpse of their past, Werther showed them their present. It was Goethe's first attempt at what Lukács called the educative novel, in which man learns a practical understanding of reality. In Werther, this education concerns the true nature of desire. That children do not know the reason of their desires, all the learned teachers and instructors agree, Werther writes. Yet, he fails to see that his desire to express the full force of his personality and his despair when he cannot are far from unique. Just as Lotte's rejection feels scripted to him, all that should be printed, he tells her, and we could recommend it to educators, so too to us do the passionate effusions of Werther's letters, which mimic the verse that an educated man of his times could be expected to have absorbed. Werther, in his self-delusion, embodies another Goethean type, the longing man, ordinary but convinced of the extraordinariness of his feelings. Werther became a fashion because it was about a fashion, Boyle observes. When the book was published, both those who swooned over it and those who censored it failed to catch its satiric edge. It was a good thing they hadn't. Goetz had made Goethe's name in Germany, but Werther vaulted him to international renown. He was 25 years old. Weimar came calling for Goethe's services in 1774, weeks after Werther, and he answered with enthusiasm. It was a match of convenience. The Dowager Duchess believed that Goethe would help her teenage son, the Duke, mature into a benevolent despot. Goethe believed that a small polity would be better than a large one for testing his political acumen. The duchies of Weimar and Eisenach will be a stage on which one can try out whether a role in worldly affairs suits one or not, he wrote. He was not cheap, but he was a good catch, according to his valet, lean, nimble, and dainty. He thought he had the strength of mind to withstand the tedium and the pettiness of court. Much of Goethe's time was spent putting out fires, literally in the villages, and figuratively in the overspent treasury, the understaffed university, and the collapsing mines. At court, he was perceived as minister-like and cold. He valued order, precision, speed, and self-denial. With the Duke, matters were different. The rumored adventures of the 26-year-old poet and his 18-year-old prince were crass and likely exaggerated. They dug potatoes from the earth, cooked them with kindling in the forest, slept with girls in the forest, carved inscriptions on the trees, a friend reported. Goethe, in his first decade at Weimar, lived half as a child of nature, half as a bureaucrat. He produced shorter poems and plays, essays on minerals and anatomy, and more than 1,000 letters to a lady at court. Charlotte von Stein, with whom he had a chaste and confused liaison. But he struggled to finish the ambitious projects that he had started before his arrival, the play Egmont and his first full-length novel, Wilhelm Meister's Theatrical Mission. By 1785, his friends noted his gloominess and his protracted illnesses. He asked the Duke for a reprieve to recover in the spa city of Carlsbad, and then secretly set off to Italy. Goethe had longed to visit Italy since he was a child, to see the finest works of art and hoard his memories of them as a source of private pleasure. The Italian Journey, which he wrote more than two decades after his flight south, is a reminiscence of these pleasures, the statues of Rome, the temples of Sicily, the sensual life of Naples, the satisfaction of completing unfinished works and making progress on a new drama, Faust. And for the first time, his biographers conjecture Goethe experienced the thrill of sex with a young widow he met in Rome. Goethe had discovered bodies, Boyle writes, and for a while there seemed to be nothing else. It was a scandal when Goethe returned to Weimar 2 years later and put his new discovery to use. He took, as a lover, a woman 16 years younger than him who was working as a maker of artificial flowers, Christian Vulpius. The gossips at court described her as a corpulent little female and a common whore. But their union was long and loving, producing five children, only one of whom, August, survived to adulthood, and the 24 erotic poems of Roman elegies. Their frank lustiness makes them more rewarding to read in English translation than Goethe's Volkslieder. Here it is. Also, am I not learning when, at the shape of her bosom, graceful lines I can glance, guide a light hand down her hips? Only thus I appreciate marble, reflecting, comparing. See with an eye that can feel, feel with a hand that can see. Often, too, in her arms, I've lain composing a poem. Gently, with fingering hand, count the hexameter's beat out on her back. If Werther was an educative novel, then elegies were educative poems. They imagined how the lover's encounter with the beloved could teach a passionate appreciation for art. The eye and the hand could gain in sensual versatility. The body could be the material, and sex the medium of aesthetic judgment and creation. He uses her body to mark time. She, meanwhile, exhales her warm breath into his mouth, Bell writes. She inspires him. The poem that emerged was the couple's shared creation. In Italy, Goethe may have gone on a holiday from reality, but the world had not. Days before he returned to Weimar, French revolutionaries stormed the Bastille. Karl August feared contagion. When anti-revolutionary Prussian troops crossed into France in 1792, he rode to the front with Goethe in tow and watched the newly constituted French Revolutionary Army unexpectedly stop the Prussian advance. Goethe, as he later recalled, told the defeated troops, "From here and now begins a new era of the world's history." Karl August's strategy for resisting the forward movement of history was to dust off the courtly practices of the ancient regime. Goethe was tasked with revitalizing the Weimar Theater and the University of Jena and dismantling all secret student societies. With his friend, the playwright Friedrich Schiller, he edited the Horae, a journal in which they argued for contracting the literary marketplace so that fewer stupid, self-regarding people published books. Neither literary nor political democracy held much appeal for him. "It is simply in my nature," he explained. "I prefer to commit an injustice than to endure disorder." Order and injustice descended on Weimar in 1806 in the form of Napoleon's army, which had already overrun Austria and Prussia. Goethe and Napoleon were often envisioned as doubles. One had conquered Europe's imagination, the other its territories. "Two great men sent among us," Thomas Carlyle later reflected. Bonaparte, like an all-devouring earthquake, hurling kingdom over kingdom. Goethe was as the mild shining inaudible light, which, notwithstanding, can make again that chaos into a creation. Goethe was torn between admiring Napoleon, observing that people have a morbid desire to carp at anything great, and fearing what might happen if the new emperor were to dissolve the duchy. When French troops entered Weimar, Goethe proposed marriage to Christiane, either because he was grateful that she stopped their house from being looted, or because the Napoleonic Code would not recognize their illegitimate child. He believed in accommodating Napoleon in the name not of peace, but of order and authority. Tragedy, Napoleon told Goethe when they met in 1808, is the highest a poet can achieve. Goethe's great tragedy, Faust, the first part, was published that year. Faust, a thwarted scholar, is desperate to know what it is that holds the world together and to personally experience all that is given to humanity, total humanity, to experience. The demonic Mephistopheles appears in the absurd form of a yapping black poodle and grants Faust his wish. But before he does, he pretends to show him another way to discover the secrets of the world. Why not write poetry? Take my advice. Engage a poet. Let him turn on his imagination and load you with all the virtues and distinction. The courage of the lion, the speed of the stag, the hot blood of Italy, the endurance of the North. Let him solve the problem of combining generosity with cunning, and plan a young man's impulsive love affair for you. I'd like to know the gentleman. I'd call him Mr. Microcosm. Faust raves that he will soar to the heights of pleasures that hurt and swoop to the depths of torments that enliven. In dizzying chains of scene, he leaps from a tavern to a witch's kitchen and from a forest cavern to a mountaintop where the whole range of living things will pass before his eyes. But to gain a total understanding of human experience, he must sacrifice his humanity, his moral sensibility. The victim of his sacrifice is Gretchen, a virgin whom Faust seduces and abandons in his devilish reverie, and who kills their illegitimate child. The Faustian bargain hunter, a third Goethean type, strikes a deal whose cost is all-consuming. His antithesis is Mr. Microcosm, a poet of imagination and virtue, generosity and cunning, hot-blooded, cool-headed, a portrait of the artist as a mature man, the creator of a little world unto himself. In the final decade of his life, Goethe was befriended by Johann Peter Eckermann, a young literary critic, who visited Weimar regularly and transcribed his conversations with the older man. Conversations with Goethe is an astonishingly intimate chronicle of what, for Goethe, was a long stretch of illness and grief, marked by the sudden deaths of Christiane and August, and by his struggle to finish both Faust, the second part, and his autobiography before he died in 1832. Goethe was reluctant to continue the latter beyond his youth. In middle age, he told Eckermann, we begin to find ourselves at odds with the world, and that is only interesting if something worthwhile comes out of it. In the case of his own life, he felt whatever may be good about it cannot be shared with others, and what can be shared is not worth the effort. A man who reflects on his life near the end tends to treat his experiences as private pains and pleasures. The biographer's task is to plunge them once more into the stream of history. Among Goethe's aspiring biographers was the great Frankfurt School critic Walter Benjamin. In 1922, Benjamin completed a difficult, dazzling essay on Goethe's last novel, Elective Affinities, whose tale of love affairs among careless aristocrats imitating noble lovers is veiled in an intricate form that includes epigrammatic diary entries, long disquisitions on chemistry, and a novella within the novel. In 1926, Benjamin was invited by the editors of the great Soviet encyclopedia to write an entry on Goethe from the standpoint of Marxist doctrine. But Benjamin soured on the assignment when the editors read his draft and complained that its Marxist exegesis went no further than repeating the phrase class conflict 10 times on every page. Benjamin's lover, Asja Laksis, agreed, sending Benjamin into a rage. when he calmed down, he spoke with her about what constituted for me the interesting thing in the theme of Goethe, how a man who had existed so thoroughly in compromises could nevertheless have accomplished something so extraordinary. Only a man who had yielded to power could have dreamed up such extravagant flights of freedom, suicide, self-sacrifice, a pact with the devil. Benjamin never completed the entry, but fragments of his draft, collected and translated by Susan Bernstein, Peter Fimbes, and Kevin McLaughlin, in a new volume on Goethe, published by Stanford, reveal a sophisticated theory of life as a compromise between the individual and his age. In an outline titled Life Built Up from the Elements, Benjamin speculated that life emerged from the dialectical dance between our innermost nature and its outward expressions, our writing, our work, our friendships, our loves. For most people, inner nature was not forceful enough to influence outward expressions in any determinable form. Hardly anyone reinvents the novel. Fewer still reinvent marriage. But Goethe's nature seemed to overpower everything. His poetry, his prose, his plays, his position at court, and his relationship with Christiana had each assumed a completely unique shape. A banal biography, Benjamin wrote, would accept that a man's nature invariably decided his fate and would infuse the story of his life with the conjuring character of mythic poetry. A materialist biography, by contrast, would measure both the freedom evinced by a great man's creations and their determination by external forces. The biography Benjamin envisaged would have explained Goethe's political nihilism and his escape into nature as equally the products of his will and of the intricate machinery of the world. The fragments assembled in On Goethe let us glimpse how carefully Benjamin heeded Goethe's own ambitions for interpreting his life. For this seems to be the main object of biography, Goethe wrote in his foreword to Poetry and Truth, to exhibit the man in relation to the features of his time, and to show to what extent they have opposed or favored his progress, what view of mankind and the world he has formed from them, and how far he himself, if an artist, poet, or author, may externally reflect them. He knew that, in the course of his existence, inner nature and history had gripped each other with ferocity. The result was a strangely spellbound life. Next, from the December 1st, 2025 online edition of The New Yorker, what can economists agree on these days? A new book, The London Consensus, offers a framework for rethinking economic policy in a fractured age of inequality, populism, and political crisis by John Cassidy. The Larry Summers era is over, Politico proclaimed after the House Oversight Committee released correspondence from Jeffrey Epstein's estate attributed to the veteran Harvard economist Lawrence Summers. That framing seemed a bit over the top. It is true, though, that in the 30-plus years that I've been writing about the economy and economic policy, Summers has been pretty much a constant presence. His sudden downfall got me thinking about what has changed in economics since he first appeared on the public stage and where it's going from here. A recently published collection of essays, The London Consensus, with the ambitious subtitle Economic Principles for the 21st Century, offers a helpful starting point. The book, which grew out of a conference held at the London School of Economics and Political Science a couple of years back, addresses a range of global issues, including trade, growth, macroeconomic stability, and inequality. It was edited by three London School of Economics economists, Tim Belsey, a specialist in economic development, Irene Buselli, a researcher on poverty and inequality, and Andre Velasco, a macroeconomist who from 2006 to 2010 served as the finance minister of Chile. When I caught up with Velasco last week, he had just returned to London from a leg of his book tour that took him to Buenos Aires and Montevideo. The question you get is, What are you economists thinking that could be useful here? He told me. Back in the 1990s, there was a ready, if controversial, answer to this question, the Washington Consensus, a term that the late British economist John Williamson coined in 1989 to describe 10 policy prescriptions that global economic agencies, such as the International Monetary Fund and World Bank Group, with the backing of the U.S. government, were imposing on developed countries as a condition of receiving aid or debt relief. The Washington remedies included deficit reduction, deregulation, privatization, and removing barriers to international flows of goods and financial capital. Protective tariffs, price controls, and other government interventions were frowned upon. Larry Summers served as the World Bank's chief economist in the early 90s. Then, during the Clinton administration, as a senior official at the Treasury Department, before eventually becoming Treasury Secretary. This was the era in which China, India, and other developing nations were rapidly integrating their economies and workforces into the worldwide capitalist system. The Clinton administration was a firm supporter of reducing trade barriers and globalization, which, as Summers pointed out, lifted hundreds of millions of people in poor countries out of acute poverty. Globalization and trade liberalization also come with downsides, of course, including financial instability, which manifested in the Asian financial crisis of 1997-98 and the global financial crisis of 2007 to 2009, and offshoring, fueling the rise of economic populism, which, in the Trump years, has led to a sharp turn away from free trade and open markets. During this turbulent period, there were also significant changes within the economic profession, Velasco recalled. Empirical studies gained prominence, and some economists, at least, recognized the need to be less dogmatic and to be more willing to draw upon insights from other fields, such as psychology and political science. The London Consensus traces this evolution. It includes contributions from dozens of economists who have either taught or studied at the London School of Economics. But, as Velasco put it, you will not find 10 commandments that are universally applicable. Rather than making blanket policy pronouncements, he and Besley outline several general economic principles in a lengthy introductory essay and then apply them across various policy domains, while highlighting the value of care and gradualism and pragmatism. As defined by Besley and Velasco, the London Consensus does not throw out all the Washington Consensus. Like its predecessor, it prioritizes fiscal prudence and low inflation. But it also emphasizes the importance of regulating the financial system effectively to prevent booms and busts, and asserts that policymakers should not shy away from occasionally using foreign exchange controls to prevent destabilizing short-term capital flows. In keeping with the Washington Consensus, the London version says that global trade generates substantial economic gains overall. But, in an essay detailing the evidence to support this claim, the MIT economist Dave Donaldson points out that trade liberalization creates not only winners, but losers, and that the hits to jobs and income can have a lengthy negative impact on whole regions and even entire countries. We see this where negative trade shocks have left places in a low-level trap, persistent across multiple generations, and in those countries that have failed to establish new industries that are internationally competitive. Anthony Venables of Oxford writes in a comment on Donaldson's essay, one of the general principles of the London Consensus is growth matters, but so does place. To cushion trade shocks, it calls for the losers to be compensated financially and for governments to invest in infrastructure and education to make economically depressed regions more attractive to outside companies. During the 90s, some officials inside the Clinton administration advocated for trade adjustment policies of this nature, but they didn't make much progress. Now they have been vindicated. the structural changes required to make the most of trade opportunities and to adjust to trade shocks often require systematic policy intervention, Venables argues. 30 years ago, many mainstream economists regarded industrial policy with deep suspicion. The London Consensus embraces it, albeit under a different moniker, productive development policies, which encompasses everything from investing in skills and infrastructure to ensuring access to key raw materials to setting up a regulatory structure that encourages innovation and punishes corporate predation. Economic growth requires an enabling environment, the lion's share of which is created by deliberate government action, Besley and Velasco write. What about tariffs? A central element of the Washington Consensus was its commitment to freer trade. Noting the shift toward protectionism in recent years and the acceleration of this trend since the start of Trump's second term, Besley and Velasco state, our principles do not rule out all protection measures categorically. Then they add, this certainly does not mean that any old protectionist policy is justified. When I pressed Velasco on this ambiguity, he said tariffs shouldn't be used to expand the life of mature industries, but under certain circumstances, they could be utilized in conjunction with other policies to help develop industries of the future. This reasoning certainly would not support Trump's 50% levy on steel imports or his blanket tariffs on goods from more than 100 countries. But could it justify the hefty levies on Chinese electric vehicles that the Biden administration introduced as part of its effort to stimulate green manufacturing? The London Consensus endorses green growth as a goal. Still, Velasco didn't seem very enthusiastic about using protectionist measures to advance it. If you think of the list of tools that governments can use to stimulate growth and development, tariffs are pretty far down the list, he told me. Another contributor to the London Consensus is Philippe Aguillon, the French economist who shared this year's Economics Nobel Prize for his theoretical work on how creative destruction drives economic growth. Citing this research, the London Consensus advocates for policies that stimulate innovation. Some of the recommendations, such as supporting scientific research, are obvious. Others are not. In an essay co-written with John Van Rienen of the London School, Aguillon calls for stricter antitrust policy, particularly in regard to corporate mergers. The issue is that established tech giants such as Alphabet and Meta have a strong incentive to monopolize their markets and to acquire nascent innovators whom they view as threats. Governments can make our economies both more innovative and more inclusive by constantly favoring the entry of new innovative firms and the emergence of new talents, Aguillon and Van Rienen write. Protecting the interests of small innovative firms aligns with the London Consensus's commitment to empowerment, which includes supporting labor unions and policies that promote gender equality in the workplace, such as parental leave and child care. Another significant departure from the Washington Consensus is the understanding that inequality cannot be ignored, not only because of the harmful effect it can have on individuals' lives, but also because of its broader consequences for economic development and political systems. Francisco H.G. Ferreira, a former World Bank economist who teaches at the London School of Economics, reminds us that the notion that high levels of wealth inequality can lead to capture of the state by a self-interested elite harks back to Plato's Republic. The fact that economists have belatedly rediscovered it is surely a welcome development. So is the recognition that there is no good economics without good politics, another general principle that Besley and Velasco outline. During the 90s, Velasco reminded me, there was an implicit belief that if you got the economics right, politics would get sorted out along the way. The shortcomings of this approach were illustrated by the blowback to globalization and the global financial crisis. We learned from the fate of the Washington Consensus that if a policy is forced down people's throats, it is not going to be long-lasting, Velasco said. This is essentially the same insight that Karl Polanyi, the Austro-Hungarian political economist, had nearly a century ago, as he witnessed the disasters of the interwar period, which he attributed to a misguided effort to recreate the laissez-faire system of the late 19th century. Polanyi argued that the economy is embedded in and subordinate to a pre-existing set of social structures, and efforts to reverse this chain of authority inevitably lead to powerful counter-reactions, which can be as peaceful or as violent as circumstances dictate. Polanyi regarded fascism or socialism as the two most likely outcomes of this dynamic in the early 1930s. After the New Deal and the Second World War, though, he became somewhat more sanguine about social democracy and its potential to restore balance between markets and society. Although Beazley and Velasco don't mention Polanyi explicitly, the London Consensus makes clear the need to keep economics and politics in an equipoise. As societies cope with the fallout from globalization, technological change, and climate change, and deal with the reality of populism and polarization, there is a growing risk that politics will be the source of economic shocks. To help forestall this danger, policymakers need to be mindful of whether a given policy helps or hinders the building of social cohesion, a consideration that is absent from a purely economic approach. The prospect of an AI revolution, attended by further economic and social dislocation, arrived too late for the London School economists to consider at length. But the potential risks only add to the urgency of their task. Questions can be raised about how far the viewpoints in the London Consensus extend beyond the London School of Economics. Even without the volume, there are significant differences of opinion between its contributors, and whether it represents a big enough break with the past. But its overall attempt to broaden the economic lens is commendable. As Velasco said, what we are seeking isn't just an economic consensus, it's a political economy consensus. And now, from the November 20th, 2025 online edition of The New Yorker, a startup's bid to dim the sun. The gloomy arguments in favor of solar geoengineering are compelling, so are the even gloomier counterarguments. By Elizabeth Colbert. Stardust is the name of a small startup with enormous ambitions. The company, which is based in Israel and registered in Delaware, proposes to do nothing less than dim the sun. Its business plan is modeled on volcanoes. In a major eruption, millions of tons of sulfur dioxide get thrown up into the stratosphere. There, the gas reacts to form droplets of sulfuric acid that scatter sunlight back to space. The result is that less energy reaches the Earth and the planet cools. After Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines blew its top in 1991, average global temperatures dipped by almost 1 degree Fahrenheit. Stardust seeks to market eruptions of its own. It is working to develop highly reflective particles that could be sprayed above the clouds, where they would drift around mirror-like, and the theory goes, help combat global warming. The company calls this scheme sunlight reflection technology, although it is more commonly known as solar geoengineering. In one form or another, the idea has been kicking around for decades, but Stardust has taken it a major, some might say terrifying, step forward. The company says it has created a new sort of reflective particle, the specific makeup of which it has so far declined to reveal. It states that the particles are made from a material that is safe for humans and ecosystems. And recently it announced that it had raised $60 million in venture capital to pursue its plans, which include developing a dispersal system that could be used to spray the particles into the stratosphere. Investors include several firms based in the United States, including Future Ventures, headquartered in Los Altos, California, as well as several funds from Europe. Stardust itself is not planning to deploy any of the technologies it's creating, a move that would require specialized aircraft. As one of the company's co-founders, Yanai Yedbab, explained to me in a Zoom interview the other day, "We see ourselves as the technological enablers, which develop the toolkit and provide the information for decision makers in the different governments that will be involved." There are compelling arguments to be made for geoengineering, and these begin with the grim situation that we're in. At the so-called Earth Summit, held in Rio de Janeiro in 1992, the U.S. and the vast majority of the nations on Earth pledged to prevent dangerous climate change. Since then, global carbon emissions have roughly doubled. In 2015, the countries of the world made another heartfelt commitment, this time to pursue efforts to hold anthropogenic warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius, almost 3 degrees Fahrenheit. Last year, temperatures nudged above 1.5 degrees Celsius, and it now appears increasingly unlikely that nations will limit warming to even 2 degrees Celsius. A climate change denier currently occupies the White House, and his administration is doing everything it can to lock in as much domestic fossil fuel production as possible. It is also trying, with some success, to force its allies to do the same. A recent scientific report suggested that, even under the most optimistic warming scenario, the world's coral reefs are still headed for oblivion. The oceans have simply become too hot for reefs to survive. Earth's climate and nature are already passing tipping points, the report's authors warn, and with every additional increment of warming, the chance of more irreversible damage grows. Another round of international climate negotiations is currently underway in Brazil, which the U.S. is not participating in. It seems doubtful that it will yield any major breakthroughs. Advocates for geoengineering, or at a minimum of pursuing research into geoengineering, say that such risks impose obligations. They note that since attempts to limit warming have failed, it's incumbent on humanity to consider all the options. If sunlight reflection could save lives and protect the environment, it is at least worth discussing, David Keith and Zeke Hausfather, both climate scientists, wrote in a recent essay for the New York Times. "I don't think we have the luxury of saying there are certain options we don't explore and study," Yedvab, the co-founder of Stardust, said. "Just as a metaphor, if there is one person in a household who's in crisis, you want to make sure that you have all the options in front of you of how to deal with this crisis." The gloomy arguments for geoengineering are compelling. So are the even gloomier counterarguments. Among the technology's many possible side effects are shifts in regional weather patterns and the disruption of monsoons that hundreds of millions of people depend on. Since solar geoengineering would have global impacts, it would seem to demand that some sort of global agreement be in place before it could be deployed or even tested on a meaningful scale. But it is hard to see how such an agreement could be reached, as conditions that benefit one region might very well flood or dry out another. Meanwhile, in the absence of such an agreement, there's nothing to stop a powerful country or group of countries from utilizing the technology, except for the fear of disapproval or that another country will shoot down their planes. A company called Make Sunsets is already selling cooling credits for lofting small quantities of sulfur dioxide into the stratosphere via balloons, though it is unclear whether this is having any effect on anything. Stardust says that it is committed to comprehensive regulation of this emerging field, including governance mechanisms for the stratosphere. So far, though, it has been moving ahead without these. Another geoengineering downside, and it is a deep one, is its duration. Were the world, or any subdivision of it, to embark on a campaign of sunlight reflection, the scheme would have to be continued more or less indefinitely. After a volcanic eruption, reflective droplets fall out of the stratosphere within a few years. The same, presumably, would hold for any man-made particles, meaning that these would have to constantly be replaced. If they weren't, temperatures would suddenly shoot up, a prospect that's become known as termination shock. Finally, and most important, solar geoengineering is not a solution to climate change. It is a way, once again, in theory at least, to depress global temperatures. But the technology does nothing to deal with the underlying problem, which is carbon dioxide emissions. Using it to counter the effects of warming while carbon emissions continue to rise is a bit like cranking up your thermostat and then turning on the AC. In the 3 decades since the summit in Rio, our technologies have grown ever more powerful, ever more rapidly. ChatGPT, interceptor drones, humanoid robots, mRNA vaccines, quantum computing, one mind-blowing breakthrough follows quickly on another. But our institutions, the United Nations, the U.S. Congress, American higher education, have failed to keep pace. They seem increasingly sclerotic, or perhaps just ineffectual. The net effect is to make ambitious techno-fixes such as geoengineering increasingly attractive. Presumably, this is what prompted Stardust investors to hand over $60 million. It is also what should make us wary. Technologies do not manage themselves. And as usual, I'll end with a poem. This one from the November 25th, 2025 issue of The New Yorker, The Loved Ones by Wendell Berry. The loved ones we call the dead depart from us and for a while are absent. And then, as if called back by our love, they come near us again. They enter our dreams. We feel they have been near us when we have not thought of them. They are simply here, simply waiting, while we are distracted among our obligations. At last, it comes to us. They live now in the permanent world. We are the absent ones. Well, we've run out of time for today's issue of the New Yorker magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and/or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Okay, that number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.